Talk Show.
Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you are already starting to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and he shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is February 14, 2010, Sunday, and Bill Fink is joining us for the latest installment of Russia Number 1, the collection of reports on Bolshevism in Russia, detailing the Bolshevik Revolution. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello. Praise Yahweh.
Absolutely. Praise Yahweh. So when last we left, we were just about to begin with report number 59, the progress of Bolshevism abroad.
Okay. Do you want to read or should I?
Well, you said you wanted to read something from the Bloody Red Streak.
Yeah, we'll do the report first.
Okay.
It doesn't matter one way or the other.
I'll begin. The Progress of Bolshevism Abroad, number 59, Memorandum by Mr. B. From a report recently received from a former Russian statesman, it certainly appears that Bolshevism is dying at its roots. He says that the split between the Lenin and Trotsky group has become menacing. The few idealists that still remain among the Bolsheviks are seeing their ideas falling to pieces one after another, while a world revolution is still hanging fire. The leaders, who have full details of the position of Bolshevism both in Russia and abroad, clearly foresee their downfall and admit their discouragement in private conversation with their friends. The middle Bolsheviks, for example, the commissars, Soviet staff, and officers of the Red Army, knowing nothing of the progress of events except what they read in the Bolshevik press, are less dismayed. They still believe in the eventual victory of Bolshevism in Germany and are looking forward to disturbances in England. But many of them are already looking out for hiding places, and it is believed that they will desert the Bolsheviks as soon as there is another revolution. The minor Bolsheviks, communist workmen, etc., are not concerned with politics at all. Their sole preoccupation is the question of food. Those who are living at the Smolny seem to be convinced of the early downfall of the Soviet government, owing to disorganization in the Red Army, revolts in the villages, and famine. Many of them are returning to their homes and throwing off the mask of Bolshevism. The mass of the townspeople are terrorized and incapable of any independent action. Underfeeding is having its effect, and the epidemics of typhus, smallpox, and influenza are spreading rapidly. In the Obushov hospital during December, the mortality amounted to 14,000. During that month, the population of Petrograd fell by 105,000. Next to disease and famine, the absence of fuel is the worst scourge. This presses terribly upon the prisoners, who are now thrust 8 into a cell intended for one person and fed upon putrid herrings and soup made from potato peel. Typhoid, smallpox, and influenza cases are left in the same cell with uninfected persons, and in quarantine cells, 8 to 10 patients lie together. There is complete disorganization of transport. The Bolsheviks are doing all they can to postpone the day of complete breakdown by giving superior diet to the railway workers, who are very discontented. The Red Army continues to hold together, but its morale is said to have declined. The morale of the fleet is in a dangerous state. Many of the sailors have amassed a fortune during the past year, and they believe that they can only retain it by bringing in a bourgeois government. They are now not only discontented, but anti-Bolshevik. In the beginning of January, they demanded the removal of commissars from ships, which was done. An attempt made by the government to send the sailors to the front was disastrous. They refused to go and refused to be disarmed. The relations between the sailors and officers have lately improved, and the Bolshevik leaders are aware of the danger of having in the very center of Petrograd a compact armed force hostile to them. All that the sailors need for taking action is a leader. There is no labor question in Petrograd because there are no capitalists, no trade, and no industry. The workmen, who used to number hundreds of thousands, may now be counted in thousands. Many of them have taken service under the Bolsheviks and are employed in various commissariats and committees. Large numbers have drifted away into the country. On the whole, those who remain are against the Bolsheviks. They control the water supply, the electric fire stations, the tramways, and arsenal. They appear to entertain no ill feeling towards the bourgeoisie, but on the other hand, they are quite inarticulate as to the form of government they would prefer. At the Putilov Works, anti-Semitism is growing, probably because the food supply committees are entirely in the hands of Jews, and voices can be heard sometimes calling for a pogrom. In the railway workshops, the men are split into two parties, Bolshevik and anti-Bolshevik. The government is carrying on a feverish propaganda among them, but without much effect. The women folk are specially counter-revolutionary, probably because they feel the want of food more severely. The workmen are generally opposed to the Red Army and against war of any kind. The food supply, in which there was a temporary improvement during January, has again become hopeless. In Petrograd, there is no reserve of food. The peasants in the northern governments are generally anti-Bolshevik, but the feeling varies in the different governments and is most hostile where requisitions have been made. The committees of the poor are avoided by respectable peasants. Members of those committees, numbering sometimes 20% of the population, do no work and live at the expense of the local peasants by requisition. This led to revolts in January in several districts. Nearly all the peasants are armed, some even having machine guns and a supply of cartridges. They have ceased to take the slightest interest in politics. What they need is cloth and iron as well as food. The most interesting features in the report is the statement that both in the towns and villages there is a reawakening of religion. At Kolpin, the churches are overcrowded. The propaganda of Ivan Trichkov is meeting with success. Pachkov's sect is growing, and new sects are appearing. In the villages also, the priests are no longer molested and are beginning to reopen the churches. At the International Communist Conference at Moscow, according to the Russian wireless, Kamenev declared for the doctrines of Karl Marx and a proletarian dictatorship. Lenin spoke hopefully of the victory of the social revolution being secured, in spite, he said, quote, of all the obstacles and the number of victims who may suffer in the progress of the cause, we may live to see a universal republic of Soviets, end quote. There was to be a review of the Red Army for the edification of the foreign delegates. The Red Army is flooded with propaganda literature, and Trotsky is conducting a series of mass meetings. The propaganda trains are decorated fantastically in order to make an impression on the soldiers. Trotsky's present theme is the coming of the socialistic state. Stoppage of work in factories is almost universal, not only from the lack of fuel, but from strikes. The Russian wireless has issued a statement that the government, although not recognizing the Bern conference as representative of the working classes, will allow the commission to travel through Russia just as they would allow any bourgeois commission to do the same, but they inquire whether the governments of the various countries' representatives will allow a Bolshevik commission to inspect their countries. A man named Jay, who has arrived in Norway from Russia, states that he was employed as an engineer at a printing works. In the spring of 1918, the press was taken over by the Soviet government and was employed in printing propaganda in many languages. Every language, he says, quote, except Russian, end quote. Most of the matter printed was in German, but there was a good deal of English too, as well as leaflets in Asiatic languages, for which purpose type was purchased in India. He specially remembered Sanskrit and Hindustani. The efforts of the Bolsheviks to corrupt the Allied soldiers at Arkhangel are reported to be futile. Specimens of the literature dropped by Bolshevik aeroplanes comprised English translations of manifestos by Lenin and Petrov, a man who was charged in connection with the Hunsditched murders. There are many reports about the printing of forged notes for the various Allied countries, and the one-pound note is reported to be forged in enormous quantities. The only forged notes now being circulated in this country are very crude and are quite unworthy of the style of note printing for which the Russians used to be famous. Most of the forgery has been badly executed by hand on inferior paper. End report.
That's incredible that they are already, they don't have full control of Russia yet, but they're already spreading this overseas. Just total anarchy everywhere.
Absolutely.
Is what
and we can see the same theme again and again. the people are only going along for food. They could care less about politics, and all the soldiers are ready to rise up the minute either foreigners come to help them or domestic leadership rises up. And, of course, that never happens since the bankers aren't going to let the American army come to their aid, are they?
No, absolutely not. And to spread Bolshevism in Germany at this point is another attempt to undermine the Kaiser. It's the capital. I don't know about Bolshevism in England, but it seems to me that they're just trying to undermine the continent. There are Jews and communists and Marxists in England, no doubt. But I don't, you know, with the English capitalists financing the Russian Bolshevists that we've already established, it would be incredible that they would want to bring Bolshevism to England at this time, especially since it was already run by Jews. And I'd like to read from Jewish Communism, The Jewishness of Communism Outside of Russia, from Trevor David, The Bloody Red Streak. Seven of the Polish Communist Politburo of 11 are Jews under the dictatorship of the rich upper-middle-class Jew, Jacob Berman. The deputy dictator is the Jew, Colonel Okab. The Times on August 10, 1949 stated that 9 out of the 11 members of the Communist Cabinet of Poland were of the middle class. In Hungary, the Communist dictator is the Jew, Rakosi. And until as recently, Communist Cabinet consisted of 5 Jews and 1 Gentile. The Foreign Minister, Laszlo Radzik, who was not a, you know, he was the Gentile. The Times of June 20th, 1949 also stated that there was only one Gentile, meaning Radzik, among the leaders of the Hungarian Communist Party. Since then, the solitary Gentile has been hanged for charges of anti-Semitism. And I'm going to skip part of that. In Czechoslovakia, the communist dictator is the Jew, Slansky. Well, what a name for a Jew. While 5 of the 8 eight-man Czech Communist Politburo are Jews. In Romania, the communist dictatoress is the Jewess, Anna Parker.
I think we should clarify, though, that this is post-World War II, when the Soviets were putting all these puppet regimes into power in Eastern Europe. So this isn't affiliated with the Bolshevik Revolution.
Well, right, but it's not. You're right. This is post-World War II, but it just shows the
how it spread.
The image, how Bolshevism, how communism spreads, is through the Jews. There's no doubt, and I'm about to cite some more dates. Just a few more. I want to just draw a picture of that. The communist dictator of the Ukraine is the Jew Manuelsky, and its president is the Jew Kornichuk. It will be remembered that this Jewish president of the Ukraine came to London in June 1950 at the request of the British Communist Party, and in a speech with the Negro Paul Robeson, told British workers to sabotage their country's defenses against Russia. A few months later, the British, quote-unquote, Communist Party asked another big Jew from Russia to come and do the same thing in Trafalgar Square, Ilya Ehrenberg. The head of the 6-million-strong South American Labor Confederation is the Jewish millionaire Toledano. Jewishness of Communism in the British Empire. South Africa's first communist MP is the Jew, Samuel Kahn, while the chairman of the South African Communist Party is the Jew, I. Horowitz. In Canada, most of those involved in Soviet espionage were found to be Canadian Jews, while Canada's communist MP Rose and the organizer of the Communist Party, Carr, both Jews, have now been jailed for selling atomic secrets to Russia. Jewishness of Communism in the USA. The top communist intellectuals in the USA are the Jews A. Kahn and A. Bittleman. Of the 11 leading American communists sentenced for conspiracy, 6 are Jews and 2 are Negroes. And that's just the point is that the whether it's 1918 or 1949, the Jews are behind communism everywhere.
And the same in 2010.
That's the point. And we have the spread of communism overseas. And the Dutch, I don't know if you could dig that quote out, that Dutch.
I have it right here.
That Dutch ambassador who talked about the spread of Jewish communism. Well, or the spread of communism overseas, and it's clear that if we didn't have Jews, we probably wouldn't have communism.
Well,
we wouldn't have a problem with Bolshevism.
On September 17, 1918, the Dutch minister at Petrograd said the following: the foregoing report will indicate the extremely critical nature of the present situation. The danger is now so great that I feel it my duty to call the attention of the British and all other governments to the fact that if an end is not put to Bolshevism in Russia at once, the civilization of the whole world will be threatened. This is not an exaggeration, but a sober matter of fact, and the most unusual action of German and Austrian consul generals, before referred to, in joining in protest of neutral legations, appears to indicate that the danger is also being realized in German and Austrian quarters. I consider that the immediate suppression of Bolshevism is the greatest issue now before the world, not even excluding the war, which is still raging. And unless, as above stated, Bolshevism is nipped in the bud immediately, it is bound to spread in one form or another over Europe and the whole world, as it is organized and worked by Jews who have no nationality and whose one object is to destroy for their own ends the existing order of things. The only manner in which this danger could be averted would be collective action on the part of all powers.
Absolutely. And we've seen it happen. And in 1949, it was still happening. But the British read this report in 1919 and did nothing about it.
Well, it was addressed to Mr. Balfour, and wasn't Balfour a Jew?
Well, right, but I mean, this report was released to the British political class before they retracted it, or at least to a great number of them.
And the king certainly could have helped its circulation, couldn't he?
Absolutely, but it seems that the Brits went along with its suppression and went along basically with the spread of communism. That's what it seems to everybody that knew about this report in 1919. Basically, if they didn't speak out against it, they acceded to it. I'm going to read report number 60.
Well, you mentioned Paul Robeson a minute ago, didn't you, from the Bloody Red Streak?
Yes.
In case people don't know who Paul Robeson is, I just wanted to point out that he was an NAACP activist. He also held the Stalin Peace Prize. He spent a long time in the Soviet Union. He remained loyal to Stalin until the end, even as black communists in the Soviet Union were being put to death and Stalin was purging people. He still was an apologist for Stalin. He helped organize international brigades, I think, during the Spanish Civil War. And then he did the English language version of the Soviet anthem. He's the most famous singer to sing the Soviet anthem in English. And there's a high school named after him in Chicago.
And it's just incredible that we could name schools after people like this.
And
people buy into this propaganda that capitalism is the antithesis of communism.
It's not.
And then we're naming schools after Negro communists. It's incredible.
Are we a capitalist society? I mean, obviously, you know. And incidentally, this high school, I believe it's 95% black. It has a 20% graduation rate, and 75% of all the female students are pregnant.
And I'm sure that 80% of the 20% that graduated probably still can't read.
And they probably don't even know who Paul Robeson is.
No, I'm sure they don't. Appreciation of the economic situation, compiled from statistics in the possession of His Majesty's government. Bolshevik financial methods and Bolshevik currency. A. General. We see throughout the area controlled by the Bolshevik autocracy a destruction of industrial and commercial system which has been based on the models of Western civilization. Bona fide commerce and industry is at a standstill. Necessities of life are scarce and obtainable only at exorbitant prices, expressed in terms of a depreciated currency issued without regard to sound principles of finance. The peasant, that sounds like American economic policy today. The peasants employed in the agriculture and thus controlling the essential products of the soil are less imbued with Bolshevism than the factory hands and town dwellers. They will not sell their supplies for depreciated currency, but part with them only in exchange for the necessary products of those trades and industries mainly centered in the towns, which Bolshevism has paralyzed or destroyed.
And that's where we're heading in this nation.
Absolutely. Well, they didn't destroy our trading industry here. They just moved it to China. But we still don't have it. We're still defrauded of it.
I mean, when it comes down to it, why would the small family farmer trade milk and eggs for worthless paper funny money?
Well, right. That's probably what it's going to come to. There can be no two opinions as to the fact that the basis of national and international trade and industry is vitally bound up with the banking system. If, therefore, the situation created by the nationalization of all Russia's banks is examined, it will go far to show that the assertion freely made that the banking system is completely broken down is perfectly justifiable. And further, that this being so, trade and industry in the accepted sense, when they are not at a standstill, are at any rate not being conducted on an economically sound basis. The paralyzing effect which Bolshevik decrees have had upon trade and industry may be thus illustrated. B. The nationalization of bank balances. In effect, this is a provision by which all current accounts become governmentally controlled. Permits to draw on such accounts are granted up to 1,000 rubles per month, without any regard to the amount standing to the credit balance of such accounts. As a result, no individual... no individual commercial house, shop, or business of any kind, which is not controlled by a duly authorized Bolshevik committee, has a credit value of more than 1,000 rubles per month. If it be taken into consideration that the life of any Bolshevik committee is very precarious and depends to a great extent on the number of bayonets supporting it, it will be clearly understood that the ordinary system of trade and industrial credits has ceased to exist. And that's, they're doing this in a different way here, that they have basically made it very difficult for companies today. I mean, they haven't frozen their accounts, but none of them save money today. They all have to borrow money, and they've made it very difficult for companies to borrow money today.
Absolutely. Well, what was it that I think Lenin or Marx, or they may have both said a quote along these lines, that the bourgeois should be crushed between the hammer of taxation and the anvil of inflation. And haven't they done that in this country?
They've absolutely done that in this country. All securities, including government stocks, treasury bills, bank trading, and industrial stocks and shares have been nationalized. And this talk about nationalizing, amongst some of the Jews in the White House, especially that, I can't even come up with his name now. I don't even want to say it anyway. They basically have talked about nationalizing large parts of the economy in favor of Social Security retirement benefits, nationalizing IRAs, and I mean, it's mostly rumors, but it's scary that the rumors are even there.
I found an article that they're probably going to nationalize retirement accounts.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean, the IRAs. And that's money that, over and above Social Security, that people have taken in their own initiative to save, and they would be deprived of it. That's absolute communism.
Well, Bolshevism penalizes people for planning ahead.
Well, absolutely. There's no doubt.
Anybody with a small amount of savings or one employee or one family worker on their farm is bourgeois.
Well, if you have one employee, you're the enemy. There's no doubt. They're going to give you... make you live on 2 ounces of bread a day and use you for slave labor if they find that out. All securities, including government stocks, treasury bills, bank trading, and industrial stocks and shares have been nationalized. After a rough and ready valuation, holders of such securities are credited with a cash balance subject, of course, to the embargo mentioned. A few comments are illuminating evidence of Bolshevik failure. The People's, quote-unquote, bank can hardly claim any depositors, despite the fact that the last banking institution, Moscow Narodny Bank, which remained outside the nationalization decree, was taken under government control 2 months ago. In other words, the People's Bank, the only remaining bank, inspires no confidence. This lack of confidence arises from several different causes. Among them may be numbered the absolute insecurity arising out of the wholesale corruption prevalent throughout the Bolshevik administration, and particularly in the bank administration. The malversation of incredibly large sums of money is of daily occurrence. other causes are the insufficiency and incompetency of the bank staffs. In fact, the interest of 3% payable on all bank balances is hardly ever credited. It is no exaggeration to state that under the Bolshevik financial regulations, there has been a complete breakdown of the credit system. The check has fallen into disuse. There are no longer any securities to enable a trade or an industry to obtain credit, and loans cannot be raised. Sounds like America today. And that was America during the Great – that was the exact method they used during the Great Depression, was to cut off all credit.
And that's odd, though, because generally there's always a Jew willing to loan you money at some exorbitant rate. But I think it gets to a point where they get consumers dependent on the loans, and then all of a sudden they cut off the loans. They basically pull a rug out from under you.
Well, right. And once they cut off the loans, they're able to buy up the industry at bargain basement prices.
Mm.
Or to simply destroy it so that they could start over and they own it.
A lot of companies take out loans on an ongoing basis to pay off ongoing and you know, recurring debts. So they basically cut off the credit flow, and then they call in all the existing loans.
Right. If you look at A. Homer, I have a quote here from A. Homer and Judaism and Bolshevism right in front of me. Bolshevism has opened the way to a Jewish industrialization of Russia and Siberia. It may deliver India and the Far East into the hands of international Jew finance. That's evident in the fact that they've destroyed everything in Russia so that they could rebuild it on their own foundation, basically.
Mm.
That they destroyed the current Russian economy so that they could build up a slave economy, which is exactly what they did. And they're doing that here in a different way. It may well be asserted that with production ever on a decrease, in some industries it has fallen to 5% of the normal, and consumption on a starvation basis, for example, the population of Petrograd, owing mainly to the emigration consequent on unemployment and disease, has dwindled from 2.25 million to about 650,000 to 700,000. So that's about 2/3 of it's gone. The economic system in Russia under Bolshevik influence has had the disastrous results of completely paralyzing the trade and industry of the country. A conclusive proof of Bolshevik economic bankruptcy is afforded by their latest budget statement for 1919, which runs as follows in round figures. Expenditures, 28 millions of rubles. Revenue, deficit to be covered by fresh issues of paper. Taxes, 2 million rubles. I guess they got a 26 million ruble shortfall. No, contributions from the bourgeois class, 10 million rubles. Currency, which they print, 16 million rubles. C. Ukraine. The first Bolshevik invasion of the Ukraine destroyed, as it did, in northern Russia, the existing trade and industrial life of the country. Well, let me say that I have an article here on the first Ukrainian Holocaust that I read from last week, and I just posted that article on the Mein Kampf site. I only posted the PDF, and I'll post the text soon. It's Ukraine, the Forgotten Holocaust. It's under the discussion menu at mk.christogeny.org. And that article states that 4 million Ukrainians died in the first Bolshevik invasion of the Ukraine.
Just in the first invasion alone of 1919-1920.
Yes, just in that first invasion alone. Okay. It failed, as it has done in northern Russia, to construct trade and industry on a new basis. The occupation by Germany of the Ukraine reimposed the old order of things. And that was until Germany had to withdraw, right? However much the economic life of the Ukraine must have suffered from these two violent and rapid changes, as an illustration of the confidence restored by the overthrow of Bolshevism, even by a foreign enemy, the reopening of the private banks at Kyiv under their old management may be quoted. Hundreds of would-be depositors of millions of rubles besieged these banks for days in succession. It is in that sounds like the bank run in 1929. It is indeed a justifiable presumption that should the Bolsheviks again make themselves masters of the Ukraine, with the greater experience they have acquired since their first inroad into that country, their demolition of trade and industry will be more thorough than on the former occasion. Here, as elsewhere under the Bolshevik rule, There will then be the same absence of security for capital and industry and the almost equal lack of security for life itself. That this is, you know, this is absolutely an economic war, because this is the bankers of England and New York using their money to destroy the banks and industry of Russia and Germany so that they could own it, which is exactly what happened.
I'm reading here on Wikipedia, historical population figures for the Ukraine. They did a census in 1905, 30.8 million. 1926, 26 million. 1931, 23.2 million. 1939, 40.4 million. Now, either someone fudged the data, or a lot of people were deported from Siberia to the Ukraine instead of the other way around. That seems odd that they would go up by 17 million people in an eight-year period, after falling 7 million due to the enforced famine and the massacres.
I don't think that we could trust the numbers from the Soviets at all.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I'll read the section of the article I was mentioning. That this is from the Bonds Review, July 1996, Ukraine, the Other Holocaust, by Peter Lorden. The terror famine of 1932-1933 was not the first. Ukraine has always struggled for independence from its enormous and aggressive neighbor. That struggle became especially fierce after the Red Revolution, when Ukraine's declaration of statehood triggered a Bolshevik invasion costing some 4 million lives. Not only was Ukraine the breadbasket of Europe, but a region of prosperous and pious farming communities. The southern Ukraine in particular exemplified those three things the Bolsheviks had sworn to abolish: private property, religion, and nationalism. After the massacre of Ukrainian leaders ordered by Lenin, who in 1918 offered his thugs a cash bounty for every landowner and priest they hanged, the 1921-22 famine caused by grain exportation killed millions more. Leon Trotsky was then heading the Red Army with General R.P. Eidemann as his grain-grabbing deputy. Said Trotsky, "That rich granary is ours." I may have read that last week. I think I did. That's okay. The Bolshevik government, to continue with report number 60, the Bolshevik government has lost large amounts of bullion, where'd it go, and have no possibility of attaining any fresh cover to their paper issue. An issue of 2 millions of paper monthly still continues. It appears that the Bolshevik government has never dared to issue paper money of their own, having relied on fresh issues of Kerensky money, which is still accepted by the people, and probably on illicit issues of, ostensibly, Tsar rubles. So they're still issuing the money from past administrations.
Because people actually believe that that'll be accepted, and that at some point that administration may return.
Yeah, well, they'll do it here too. In the event of the people ceasing to accept the present paper currency and of no organization of barter being established in its place, disaster must finally overtake the Bolshevik regime. Wishful thinking. Bolshevik relations with the Zemstvos. The nearest English equivalents to the Zemstvos are the rural district councils and the local government board. They approved of the greatest assistance during the war. Without the Union of Zemstvos, it is doubtful if the Quartermaster General's Department of the Russian Army could have coped with the situation, as they undertook practically the whole of the food organization. It is stated that the late Tsar credited them with political intrigue and wished to disband them, but this was vigorously resisted by the Grand Duke Nicholas, then Commander-in-Chief of the Russian Army. Under Kerensky, the Zemstvos were reorganized and their power amplified. It was projected that they should form the electoral machinery for the Constituent Assembly, but this scheme was not in full working order at that time. At the time that the Bolsheviks seized power, the Bolsheviks, realizing that they had to deal with the body practically controlling the agricultural supplies of the country, were very careful in their attitude at first. The Bolsheviks attacked the members of the Zemstvos on the ground that individually they were counter-revolutionary, but went no further until, with increasing power, they felt strong enough to assail the executive branches and finally the whole system. Their purpose was twofold. One, to destroy the machinery for the election of a constituent assembly. Two, to obtain a complete domination over the peasantry and consequently the handling of rural produce. Domination of the peasantry they have never really obtained, but they sowed distrust against the Zemstvos by suggesting that these bodies were retarding the distribution of the land. They had been promised land. The peasants had been promised land under Kerensky, right? The destruction of the authority of the Zemstvos was not replaced by the confidence in the Bolsheviks. The peasants refused to place their produce on the markets as it was so often sequestrated. They demanded clothing, agricultural machinery, and household goods, and refused the paper money, which was of no use to them. The vicious circle was established of complaint by the workpeople that the peasants would not supply food, and on the peasant side, the workpeople would not supply the implements necessary for their toil. The result, chaos and famine. Three.
Haven't we already established in the earlier parts of this series that land transfers from the government to the Russian peasants were booming under the Tsar, and that the Bolsheviks actually took away land from the peasants?
Yes, they were, and the Bolsheviks are against the ownership of property, so that, you know, the peasants probably believe their lies.
So when they shouted peace, land, and bread, well, that sounds really nice, but anybody who's read Karl Marx and who's read the writings of Trotsky and Lenin would know that you're not going to actually get to own the land. You're going to be on maybe a tenth of an acre plot of land with a commissar poking you in the back with a bayonet, and if you don't work hard, you're dead.
Absolutely, but the peasants would have been, I imagine they would have been, for the most part, totally ignorant of the writings of Marx and Lenin and Trotsky. Three, Bolshevik relations with cooperative societies. These are closely allied to the Zemstvos, but they have no administrative functions. The Bolsheviks were very chary of interference with these bodies in the earlier stage, recognizing that they were the embodiment of one branch of socialist thought. The cooperative societies were, and are, a body of considerable power representing the financial interests of a large proportion of the peasant population. The people's, quote-unquote, bank in Moscow, which was practically owned by the cooperatives, was for a time allowed almost unrestricted people freedom of action. A very large percentage of Russian raw material passes through the hands of the cooperatives, and the Bolsheviks realized that the resumption of trade relationship with other countries is in no small way dependent on this functioning of the cooperatives. These later have stoutly defended their rights, and many collisions have occurred in the attempts of the Bolsheviks to sequestrate money and goods belonging to them. Should the Bolsheviks succeed in the domination of the cooperatives, it will be another blow to the possibilities of reconstruction of Russian economic life. Four, nationalization of industry. First attempts at the nationalization of industry were carried out at the Putilov, the Russian Krupps, that would be a very large manufacturing outfit, and the Obukhovsky Gunworks near Petrograd. These works, in fact, provided the nucleus of the workmen's army under the Bolshevik regime, as they had also been among the first insurrectionists in the earlier revolution. The nationalization of factories developed until it included all the Petrograd works, and was eventually extended to Moscow. And let me say that weren't the most unionized industries in this country the auto plants and the steel mills?
Absolutely, and that's where the workers had it the best.
And that's where, towards the end of World War One, where the Jews had done most of their agitating in Germany, was at the armament factories.
And you have to wonder, how were they able to succeed? Because these workers had it pretty good, didn't they?
Absolutely.
Henry Ford was paying his workers $5 a day, and back in 1915, 1920, that was a phenomenal wage.
That was a week's pay for my grandmother who worked in a New England shoe factory, and probably just as hard.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's incredible.
So they basically, as Bezmianov said, they promised the masses castles in the sky, He said they make all sorts of beautiful promises without any regard for whether the promises can be fulfilled, frequently intending not to fulfill them, and then when they come to power, the masses are offended, but by then it's too late.
Well, it's the old Jewish, the same old serpent's deception over and over again.
Isn't that what Nakash said? Surely thou shalt not die, you shall be as God.
Absolutely. People fall for it every time. Okay, to continue. Having ordained the nationalization of industry, extraordinary measures were adopted by the Bolsheviks in their endeavors to secure apparent success for their schemes. When it was realized that factories could not survive the removal of the brains of the industry represented by the owners, managers, and staffs, laws were passed to protect the workpeople. Among others, a regulation that no workman could be dismissed on the grounds of ill health, incapacity, or idleness. Such questions had to be referred to the workmen's committee, who variably sided with the employee. If a workman was called up as a Red Guard, he was entitled to demand from his employer full pay during his absence on service. And in certain cases, 70% of the workpeople being absent as Red Guards, the remainder declined to work on the ground that it was impossible to operate the factory, but demanded nonetheless full pay during their idleness.
Well, isn't this just like what we have in this country? And in some countries, I've read that, like in Sweden, if a woman gets pregnant, she can leave her job and is entitled to 10 to 11 months of full 100% maternity leave pay. Now, say you're a small business owner and you have 20 employees, two are women who are out because they're pregnant, you have to pay them 100%, and either their work is distributed to others who don't get paid any more for all their efforts, or you have to bring in two temporary replacements. So now you're paying two people not to work, and you have to pay two people to come in temporarily to do the work that they're not doing.
That's communism. I mean, that's, you know, the unions here are just, they're no better than the Trotskyites.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see a difference.
Something for nothing. Doesn't the Jew always tries to push that idea, the get rich quick, the rags to riches, the idea that the American dream involves getting ahead through nothing. You just buy a lottery ticket and the next thing you know you're a billionaire. But, you know, we know something does not come from nothing.
No, ex nihilo nihil fit. The ancient Romans knew it also. The technical staff, in most cases, followed the example of their employers in declining to serve except where poverty made such a course impossible. Attempts were made by the Soviets to enforce the attendance of the staff, who in such cases attended but adopted the attitude of passive resistance. Yeah, you know, this shows the Jewish, the lack of attentiveness or care by the Jew for the actual person who produces anything out of his intellect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, they profess to care about the lowest working classes who are basically just drones, but they don't care about the creative class. They destroy the creative class.
Well,
I was just going to say all Jewish creation everything the Jew creates is perverse.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and this is the charge leveled against them in The Eternal Jew, a documentary that I was just thinking about since someone posted a link to it earlier today. And in the movie, the documentary, I'm sure you've seen it several, it's on your site, isn't it?
Yes.
The Eternal Jew, they say that the Aryan man wishes to create something of value to everyone in the community and to improve society and civilization as a whole. And to the Jew, the only thing of value is either money or his perverse, quote-unquote, artwork.
Exactly. He disdains everything that's truly creative.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, have the Jews ever founded a civilization, or have they ever sailed across an ocean and charted a new continent?
No, and it shows you how naive they are to our ways when they think that they could just strip out all of the intellectual people from a factory and expect the factory to still be able to operate.
Mm-hmm. Well, look what they did to the military. They said that the Soviet military, the Red Army, would have no ranks, no officers. Orders were optional. You didn't have to salute. In fact, you weren't allowed to salute. And if someone suggested an idea, like a course of action, we should attack this way, everyone would vote on it. Well, you know, when you're under fire and someone screams, get down, you don't sit around and take a vote. Well, gee, Sergeant, should we get down or should we continue standing?
Well, right. It's a, you know, reality is not a democracy. It's a different world.
Mm-hmm.
Mining, part 5. From 1914 to 1918, the mining industry passed through four phases. One, 1914, when output was normal. Two, 1915 to 1917, increasing output, qualified by periods of decrease owing to injudicious mobilization of working hands. 1917, the revolution. Rapid decrease in output and an increase in the cost of working. 1917, November, to date. Increasing state of chaos. Nationalization. Increase of wages to such an extent that the payment of work people had to be subsidized by the state. Output negligible. It is impossible to give in short summary full details, but a few figures are quoted from reliable sources concerning key mining industries. Coal. In the Donetsk Basin, on which industrial Russia mainly depends, the first revolution in 1917 resulted in a 13% decrease. The number of pits working in November 1918 is given as 30, compared with 390 in normal times. Only the smaller pits were working, the Bolsheviks, either purposely or through negligence, having flooded the larger pits. They probably wanted to cover the bodies. As the district contains no spare plant or repairing units, it is impossible to resume work. The Donetsk normally supplied about 1,505 million poods, which is probably about 60 million pounds, per annum. I'm sorry, it's probably about 600,000 million pounds. It's 40 pounds to a pood, right?
I believe so.
Such reconstruction and resumption of work was possible during Ukrainian anti-Bolshevik occupation, has ceased in the face of the present Bolshevik menace.
Oh, we agreed on, 40 pounds per pood?
Yes.
Yes, that's the approximation. Yes, it's about 37 pounds.
The following statistics show the terrible conditions. September 1917 output, 1.358 million tons. October 1917, 1.136. November 1917, 1.225. So it's a downward slide. Bolshevik regime, December 1917 output, 811,000 tons. January 1918 output, 491,000 tons. So it dropped by two-thirds in 4 months. In the Ural Mountains, the coal production fell from a normal 6 to 7 million poods monthly to 800 to 900,000 poods monthly, or an 86% decrease. On January 23, 1919, the Council of National Economics proposed to close down all factories, even arsenals, in order to devote all available coal to the railways. Iron. The principal iron fields of Russia are in the south, the Krivoy Rog supplying 75%, and in the Urals. The Krivoy Rog district mined about 3 million tons of ore per year prior to the war, employing 23,000 hands. The following extract from the Frankfurter Zeitung, November 7, 1917, refers to ironworks in the Krivoy Rog. At the Gdansevsky works, only 400 workmen remain. The Nikopol-Moripol works, which had a normal monthly output of 500,000 poods, produced only 17,000 poods during April 1918, and in May 1918, work stopped entirely. At the Donetsk-Yuryevska, work has been at a standstill since May 1918. At Bryansk, only 2,500 workmen remain out of 6,000, the normal number. The Bogoslavsky district in the Urals decreased in an output from 250,000 poods per month to 200,000 and less. So that's still pretty high. Up to 1st of May 1917, sums to the amount of 195 million rubles had been advanced by the government, but hitherto with no visible success in the restoration of the industry. That's what Democrats do. They throw money in and throw money in until something happens, and nothing ever happens.
And usually what happens is they get some of that money in the form of campaign donations. It's an endless cycle. They get elected from union money, and then they vote more money for the unions.
And the Bolsheviks really don't have to worry about elections, but they're still throwing money at it. Summary. The same history applies to copper, oil, manganese, and has been touched on in iron and coal. The nationalization, or rather the total allocation to the local work people of the works, was based on the firm belief that the profits shown in the past under business organization would be maintained in the future. The saner elements among the work people and the commissars realized that the pace in wages, etc., could not be maintained, but the extremists continued to agitate, and eventually the government had to subsidize the industry with its paper money in order to placate the extremist elements among the work people. Extremists, like maybe they wanted to get paid for their labor or something.
That's a novel concept, isn't it? That's a bourgeois kind of revolutionary concept.
After November 1918, owing to the rupture of relations with Ukraine and the Czechoslovak operations in the Urals, the Bolsheviks became dependent on the coal mines in the Moscow district. During the first 6 months of 1918, these mines produced 10 million poods, and the northern, which is 161,300 tons, and the northern mines produced 400,000 poods per month, or together less than 2 million poods per month, whereas Petrograd required 14 million poods per month in normal times. Agriculture. Grain. When we come to consider the great agricultural resources of European Russia, our attention is again directed to the Ukraine, which area, in spite of unsatisfactory systems of land tenure and antiquated methods of farming, produced a large proportion of Russia's total exportable surplus of grain. It exported in 1913 some 33 million tons of grain, and in addition, this region accounted for 80% of the normal production of beet sugar in Russia. Present production is hampered to a considerable extent, not merely by the original difficulties mentioned above, but by the unsettled conditions of labor and life generally produced by the war and revolution. The pillage of private estates and stores of grain, coupled with the bad conditions of transport, has deterred production, encouraged waste, and prevented the collection and distribution of the produce available. These adverse conditions have been accentuated by the deficiency of agricultural machinery. Prior to the war, nearly two-thirds of the agricultural machinery used in the Ukraine, and its use was then increasing, and further increase is now urgent, having regard to the need for improved farming, was of Russian manufacture. The factories, having been subsequently converted to war purposes and being now unable, through difficulties of labor and material, to resume their former activities, the Ukrainian cultivators have for some time past been compelled to look to outside sources for their supplies, as they will be equally compelled to do for some years to come. The available information as to the harvest of 1918 and as to the stocks existing prior to that harvest, goes to show that production, although much reduced, is still substantial. In February 1918, it was estimated that stocks of grain to the extent of some 4 million tons probably existed in the Ukraine, and that efforts to remove these stocks to the central empires would meet with only a modest degree of success, owing partly to the attitude of the peasants in refusing to part with their stocks and in concealing them, and still more to the limited supply and poor condition of the available transport. Subsequently, information has confirmed that the Central Powers have not obtained any considerable supplies from the Ukraine. The total area sown in the Ukraine by the end of 1918 spring sowings has been officially said to be as high as 80% of the normal, and this statement is probably but little exaggerated. Estimates of the yield of the 1918 harvest are somewhat variable. On August 31st, 1918, the Münchener Neueste Nachrichten, I guess that's the name of a newspaper, stated that the Ukraine harvest was above average and that 1.6 million tons would be available for export. On the 5th of September 1918, the Vossische Zeitung reported that the summer wheat and rye crops range from inferior to positively bad, while barley and oats were no better. Winter cereals, on the other hand, were above average or good. On the 18th of September, 1918, Vorwärts published an estimate compiled from official data stating that the total Ukrainian harvest would show a yield of 15,040,000 tons, of which the figures for the four principal cereals were as follows. Wheat, 5 million, rye, 3.7 million, barley, 2.8 million, oats, 1.8 million, rounded. On November 2, 1918, the Pester Lloyd, publishing closely corresponding figures, compared them with those of 1912, which was not a particularly good year, which showed that 1918 was about 25% worse in results. This report also stated that the exportable surplus would be 2.6 million tons of the prior 33 million mentioned above. On the 1st of January 1919, it was reported by the British representative at Odessa that good stocks of grain were lying in the district south of the Dnieper and west of a line running from Kherson to Perekop, while a large area was sown with winter grain. The harvest in Great Russia is stated to have been better than was expected, while in the northern provinces a serious shortage exists of seed grain. Sugar. With regard to beet sugar, of which the Ukraine area under cultivation in 1917 was said to be 572,000 hectares, as compared with 750,000 in 1914, the 1918 area will certainly not have been greater than that of 1917. The figures for production, all Russia, are as follows. 1914 to 15. I'm sorry, I don't understand this. I don't understand this abbreviation, this measure, WTS period.
DWTS period?
Yes. I don't understand this measure. Well, I'll call it units. 1914 to 15, 38.788 million units. 1915 to 16, 35.867 million units. 1916 to 17, 26.432 million units. 1917 to 18, 20.572 million units.
By the way, it means centum weight or hundred, CWT.
Okay. Well, regardless, we have
it means
almost
100 pounds.
100 pounds. Okay. Well, we have a 50% decline in output of sugar. In
right.
4 years, just about. The only report available as to 1918 to 19 sugar production makes it probable that this will fall far below even the poor result of 1917-18. Livestock. With regard to the quantity of livestock at present held in Russia, the Soviet authorities have asserted that stocks have actually increased under their regime. And it published, the people became cattle, right? And it published statistics purporting to establish their assertions. Lowest stocks must have been when the Bolshevik government was established. It is not possible that they can have increased or even kept their level, and the Soviet statistics must be regarded as fictitious or misrepresented. The Soviet authorities give no explanation as to how any increased stock has been or can be fed, nor do they state how stocks have increased in the face of an urgent demand for food in the towns, and the consequent high prices to be obtained for meat. Summary. It thus appears that agricultural conditions in Ukraine are improving, subject to the serious obstacles presented by a lack of implements and machinery, insufficient and defective conditions of transport, and in spite of unsettled conditions. That the position in the Ukraine is no worse and thus does not approximate to that obtaining in northern and Bolshevik Russia must be attributed to the comparative independence from Soviet influence which the Ukraine has succeeded in maintaining. If, however, reports are true as to the gradual encroachment of Bolsheviks into Ukraine territory, a repetition of the state of affairs existing in northern Russia is bound to occur. Inasmuch as under normal conditions, South Russia practically fed North Russia, the amount of wheat sent from Siberia being proportionately small, disorganization in the southern provinces would remove all hope of immediate relief to North Russia, excepting such foodstuffs as might be imported from abroad. Reliance can hardly be placed on immediate relief from Siberian stocks, as owing to railway disorganization, a considerable period must elapse even after the downfall of the Bolshevik regime before Siberian supplies could be sent into Russia in any quantities. As a contrast between normal conditions and the consequences of Bolshevik control, the following comparative statistics tell their tale. In pre-war times, the grain situation was as follows. Russia Empire total production, 64.5 million tons. Total interior trading grain, 20 million tons. Consumption in producing area, 37 million tons. Total available for export, 7.5 million tons. Grain situation at the beginning of 1918. European Russia total production, 43.5 million tons, two-thirds of what it was. Siberia total production, 8 million tons. Russian Empire, 51.5 million tons. Consumption in producing area, 37 million tons. Non-self-supporting districts of northern Russia and Finland require 18 million tons. Total available for export, none. Deficit in supply, 4.5 million tons. The above is based on normal ration. Government estimates at 2 pounds per man per day. The Food Ministry estimates 1917 demanded as minimum. For the Army, 645,000 tons per month. For the civil population, 484,000 tons per month. Minimum total, 1,129,000 tons per month. The Army gets 30% more grain than the civilian population. That's telling. The actual available supply proved in 1917 to be less than 50% of this total. It must be remembered that these supplies were essentially dependent on Ukraine grain being available. It may be mentioned that the government of Samara, which normally contributed 800,000 to 900,000 tons of grain to Russia's requirement, itself demanded help from outside in 1917. This was the state of affairs a year ago. Matters are still worse, even in the Ukraine, according to later information. Lacks seed grain for spring sowing. The only district approaching the normal is the Kuban. 7. Transport. General. Without sufficient transport, the existing Bolshevik regime is doomed. And they appear to have early realized the importance of obtaining control of the railways. Although to this day they have a hard fight to maintain their domination, as is instanced by the hostile reception given to Radek when attempted to address the Vologda executive of the Railway Men's Union. Rail transport. The railway personnel have shown a greater resistance to Bolshevism than any other branch of labor in Russia. This applies in the main to the operating executive, the repair and workshops being contaminated at an early date. The Railway Men's Union, Vexel, in the early days of Bolshevism, vigorously combated extremist policy. But the Bolsheviks, by careful propaganda, gradually replaced the executive with men favorable to their views. The minor officials and men on the Nicholas Railway, Petrograd, Ekaterinburg, are anti-Bolshevik but are obliged to conceal their views. A complete deadlock was reached in Moscow in December 1917 owing to the political differences between the various subunions of railwaymen, causing thousands of wagons of food supplies to be left unloaded. Order was eventually restored by the British officer taking the matter into his own hands and appointing himself controller for the time being. As an instance of the state railways were in 1917, an extraordinary commission from Petrograd decided, in view of the food crisis in Russia, to run 20 pairs of trains a day on the Trans-Siberian line. The actual number run was 6 pairs. The present decay in the maintenance of rolling stock dates from the beginning of the war. A temporary increase of efficiency was produced by the introduction of American rolling stock. But owing to the neglect and non-execution of running repairs, as much as 37% of the American locomotives on the Siberian Railway were out of action in February 1918. We're supplying Russia with rolling stock that compromises our Well, it puts us on the side of Russia in the war. It basically, I'm at a loss for the word that I'm looking for. The present decay in the maintenance of rolling stock dates from the beginning of the war. A temporary increase of efficiency was produced, by the introduction of the American rolling stock. I read that. The percentage.
You're saying we were siding with the Bolsheviks.
Yeah, right. Well, even before that, right. The percentage in European Russia is probably still greater. In the Ukraine, it was computed 6 months ago that from 45 to 50% of the rolling stock required repair. Spare parts are lacking, and the workshops could not cope with the demand, their output being diminished by the reduction of working hours, prohibition of overtime, and abolition of piecework. One of the most serious difficulties resulted from scarcity of coal. If we were sending railway material to the Bolsheviks in 1917, when did we enter World War One? I can't really exactly remember.
1918.
It wasn't until, I thought it was in 1970. It wasn't until 1918.
I believe so.
So then that definitely, we were siding with the Bolsheviks before we entered the war against Germany.
It might have been late 1917, but I thought it was just after Woodrow Wilson got reelected. So when was the election held?
Well, that election would have been held in 1917. No, that election was held in 1916, wasn't it?
All right, here I'm finding it. The U.S. declared war on
16.
Finding it here. April 1917 was when Wilson had Congress declare war.
Okay.
And Wilson had a lot of interesting things to say about the Bolshevik Revolution, too.
According to this, it's possible that the American stock didn't reach Russia until after the war declaration. The interference of the revolutionary committees in railway administration, why would it be any different than in factory administration, has not only encouraged disorder, but has increased expenditure. On the Southwestern Railway alone, it was reckoned that 16,000 superfluous employees were drawing pay at a total annual rate of 46 million rubles. That's exactly what they do here, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Well, for the whole Ukraine system, the total payable to unnecessary personnel was computed at 200 million rubles per year. Under such disastrous condition, as is only to be expected, in spite of enormously increased rates, the railways are working at a loss, and the deficit for 1918 on the railways of the Ukraine has been put at 800 million rubles. That sounds like Amtrak and Conrail. They're both government-run, too. River transport. The waterways of Russia, especially the Volga, were in normal times served by an efficient fleet of steamers and barges. The economic life of Russia is in fact bound up with the river and canal systems of the country, much of the oil and grain, practically the whole of the timber transport being affected by water. Nationalization of vessels and the extremist attitude adopted by many of the artels of the crews, bargemen, and lumberers has brought about a serious decrease in the volume of raw materials and goods carried, and thus the valuable means of communication afforded by the river and canal systems fails to be adequately utilized. And Artel is a workmen's association, another word for union. 8. Economic prospects. From a consideration of the foregoing, one is forced to the conclusion that the measures inaugurated by the Bolsheviks and the means by which they are applied can have but one end: the bankruptcy of government and the country. Sounds like the plan for America. One may be tempted to wonder that present conditions have subsisted for so long. Though the Bolshevik regime must be approaching a debacle, such are the resources and natural wealth of the country that there is still scope for a continuance of present Bolshevik rule. So long as these conditions prevail, the country is deprived of the benefits of trade and industry, and capital is destroyed. That's the plan, isn't it? Other countries who were the purchasers of Russian raw materials are cut off from these sources of supply, at a time when need for reconstructing and revictualing great areas of Europe would have rendered the produce of Russia of special value. Much of Russia's actual and potential wealth remains undiminished in value, while circumstances cause its exploitation to be impossible. This, however, does not apply to its agriculture, and during every month the position becomes more acute, so that eventually seed grain will have been consumed for food, stocks of livestock exhausted, and the difficulties of restoration and reconstruction of this great territory will be vastly increased.
And as far as American support for the Bolsheviks, can I read a quote from Woodrow Wilson from April 2nd, 1917, about how he's grateful about what's going on in Russia, and he says every American should be happy about the revolution?
Well, be my guest.
This is an excerpt from a speech of his. Does not every American feel that assurance has been added to our hope for the future peace of the world by the wonderful and heartening things that have been happening within the last few weeks in Russia? Russia was known by those who knew it best to have been always, in fact, democratic at heart, and all the vital habits of her thought and all the intimate relationships of her people that spoke their natural instinct, their habitual attitude towards life. The autocracy that crowned the summit of her political structure, long as it had stood and terrible as was the reality of its power, was not in fact Russian in origin, character, or purpose, and now it has been shaken off, and the great generous Russian people have been added in all their naive majesty and might to the forces that are fighting for freedom in the world, for justice, and for peace. Here is a fit partner for a League of Honor. That's just an absolute inversion of everything that was true about the situation, wouldn't you say? I mean, he couldn't have told more lies if he tried.
That's, he was handed that script by Colonel Mandel House, you know?
Absolutely. I imagine Wilson did not write that. He could not write that.
I'm going to read from Judaism and Bolshevism. A. Homer. The alliance between international finance and its proteges, Bolshevism and Zionism. The European War and its aftermath dealt staggering blows to Western Christian civilization. By contrast, however, international Jewry has emerged therefrom with enhanced financial and political power in all parts of the world. Through the use of the money power, international Jew finance is now able to direct the internal and external policies of the governments of the impoverished states of Europe and also of America. By this power, it has forced Gentile governments to further the political aspirations of Zionism and to refrain from protecting the interests of their own nationals from the activities of Bolshevists who are undermining the economic, social, moral, and religious systems of all states. International finance is not altruistic. It ever seeks its own material advancement and power. Europe is exhausted as a profitable investment, but Russia, Siberia, the Far East, India, and the Middle East are awaiting exploitation and would offer colossal gains to those who could superimpose upon them the mass production methods of modern machinery. Isn't that what's happening? Or what's happened the last 40 years, Bolshevism has opened the way to a Jewish industrialization of Russia and Siberia. It may deliver India and the Far East into the hands of international Jew finance. Isn't that what we've seen happen in our lifetimes? Its part is to foster world revolution and the destruction of religion so that the present social systems may be swept away, as in Russia. International finance, after the success of the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, which the Zionists had aided, realized that it stood greatly to gain by supporting the Zionist movement by forcing the Balfour Declaration on a financially harassed British government and thereby consolidating world Jewry into a powerful political factor for use in its own interests. Everything that this man wrote about so many years ago, we've seen happen in recent times. That there's no doubt. I'm trying to look at when this was written. I don't think it tells me exactly. Oh, 1933. This was reprinted from the Catholic Herald, October 31st, 21st and 28th, and November 4th, 1933.
Have you noticed how every time we fight a war to make the world safe for democracy, all we're really doing is shoring up the control the bankers have and allowing them to consolidate their financial empire over a wider area?
There is no doubt. I'm going to read a piece from Mein Kampf, page 124. Anybody who reads Mein Kampf, and anybody that thinks that Hitler was financed by the Jews should read Mein Kampf. And if they still think so, they've got to be stuck on stupid.
Or they're a Jew.
Yeah, right. This is Adolf Hitler, Mein Kampf, Murphy translation, the only valid one, page 124. When I heard Gottfried Feder's first lecture on the abolition of the interest servitude, I understood immediately that here was a truth of transcendental importance for the future of the German people. The absolute separation of stock exchange capital from the economic life of the nation would make it possible to oppose the process of internationalization in German business without at the same time attacking capital as such, for to do this would jeopardize the foundations of our national independence. I clearly saw what was developing in Germany, and I realized then that the stiffest fight we would have to wage would not be against the enemy nations, but against international capital. In Feder's speech, I found an effective rallying cry for our coming struggle. Here again, later events proved how correct was the impression we had then. The fools among our bourgeois politicians do not mock at us on this point anymore, for even those politicians now see, if they would speak the truth, that international stock exchange capital was not only the chief instigating factor in bringing on the war, meaning World War I, but that now when the war is over, it turns the peace into a hell. The struggle against international finance capital and loan capital has become one of the most important points in the program on which the German nation has based its fight for economic freedom and independence. Hitler was definitely not a pawn of the Jews.
All right. Was it the end of Report 60?
Yes.
Shall we begin 61?
Be my guest.
61. Report from a reliable source, dated Petrograd, March 21. Telegraphic. Strikes at the Putilov and other factories have been the main events of interest during the past week. The outbreak was economic rather than political. The cry for bread gave place to a new cry, down with Lenin. Both the strikes and the rising were due in part to the instigation of the Social Revolutionary Party. Now, that seems to me that it's a rather political rather than economic if they're shouting down with Lenin. Or is he saying that this is due to economic issues? We really have no idea, though, what the writer of the report is saying, since all we're told is it's a reliable source.
No, we don't. I mean, the cry for bread gave bread. Why would they? Yeah, they would cry down with Lenin if they didn't have bread. That's the way people are. They don't care about principles. They only care about bread. I mean,
well, principles are great and all, but it's hard to care about principles if you had a rumbling stomach for the last week.
Well, yeah. Right, but that's, you know, our principles should always be first. Our love for God should always be first. And
absolutely.
Rumble.
We were told that man does not live on bread alone.
Exactly.
In the various workshops, Bolshevism no longer keeps its hold, though a few factory committees endeavor to keep it alive. These committees are made up mainly of communists who maintain their power by manipulating the elections and will even introduce total strangers in order to maintain a majority, while they terrorize the workmen and compel them to vote for the Soviet candidates. The workmen now regard the factory committees as Soviet spies and believe that their words are passed on by agents who claim to be social revolutionaries and who are sent to the works in order to report on the so-called crime of political opposition. It is probable for this reason that the social revolutionaries had less to do with the rising than had the actual workmen, though the Bolsheviks would not admit this. On the 10th March, a mass meeting was held at the Putilov Works. 10,000 men were present, and a resolution was passed with only 22 dissidents, all of whom were complete strangers unconnected with the works. The following extracts show the tenor of the resolution. We, the workmen of the Putilov Works Wharf, declare before the laboring classes of Russia and the world that the Bolshevik government has betrayed the high ideals of the October Revolution and thus betrayed and deceived the workmen and peasants of Russia. That the Bolshevik government, acting as formerly in our names, is not the authority of the proletariat and peasants, but an authority and dictatorship of a central committee of the Bolshevik Party, self-governing with the aid of extraordinary commissions, communists, and police. We protest against the compulsion of workmen to remain at factories and works and the attempts to deprive them of all elementary rights, freedoms of the press, speech, meetings, inviolability of persons, etc. We demand, 1. The immediate transfer of authority to a freely elected workmen's and peasants' Soviet. 2. The immediate reestablishment of freedom of election at factories and works, barracks, ships, railway, and everywhere. 3. The transfer of wholesale management to released workmen of the professional union. 4. The transfer of the food supply to workmen's and peasants' cooperative societies. 6. The general arming of workmen and peasants. 5. 6. The immediate release of members of the original Revolutionary Peasants' Party of Left Social Revolutionists. 7. The immediate release of Marie Spiridonova. And if you'll remember, the Dutch ambassador from the Netherlands said that no aid should be given to any of the other parties, particularly the left social revolutionaries, as while they articulated a difference of opinion, their actual objectives were the exact same as the Bolsheviks.
Right. They just weren't the Jewish gang in power.
So these people, they're no different from those that they're opposing.
It's like the mafiosa families, you know. They all do the same thing, but they fight for control of it.
Are you going to be extorted by, you know, the Bananos or whoever it's going to be? You know, is it going to be, who was it?
Well, exactly.
Don Gotti or whoever?
That's what it boils down to.
And not everyone may know who Maria Spiridonova is, so I would like to read real quick as soon as I can find the page. From Bolshevism in the United States by Charles Edward Russell. I believe it's page 201. Just let me go take a look. Okay, here we go. Page 203. Marie Spiridonova, the saint and martyr of the revolution, the most wonderful soul that revolution ever produced, whose all but incredible sufferings at the hands of the fiends of the Tsar will be told so long as any chapter of the revolutionary story is told anywhere. The Bolsheviks did not hesitate to lay hands upon even her. She is the idol of the peasants, whose cause she has frequently championed. At first, she was much attracted to Bolshevism, particularly in view of Lenin's idea of the way to solve the land problem. She had understood well how the peasants were constricted by the lack of land. She had seen them slowly sinking to lower depths of poverty that in no industry or skill of theirs could better. Now that they were to have the land they needed, she thought to see an end of suffering among them. This was in the early spring of 1918. Before July came, it was apparent that the plan, so to call it, had failed. Some peasants had secured land, many more had secured none, and the great problem was as far as ever from solution. Disillusion had come to Marie Spiridonova, not only about this, but about other pretenses of Lenin. He had not been the revolutionary savior of Russia. He had not brought peace, liberty, nor light. Being without the sense of fear, it was necessary to her that she should make a declaration of her changed conception of Bolshevism and make it in the face of the nation. The occasion she chose was a public meeting at the largest theater in Moscow. Lenin was there sitting in a box. Trotsky and other eminent Bolsheviks attended. The place was crowded. Marie Spiridonova was on the stage. When she got a chance to speak, she utilized to its utmost resources what I suppose to be the greatest oratorical gift possessed by man or woman of her day. She is small and slight and apparently in ill health, but by all accounts she made the theater ring that night. For 20 minutes, the scoria of her wrath inundated Lenin, and as she proceeded, he became more visibly affected by it. She strode across the stage and thrust her small finger into his face and denounced him to all the world as the false prophet, the faithless leader of the people, the betrayer of the peasants, the traitor to liberty. The audience sat in breathless astonishment, appalled at the probable fate of the daring woman. Thousands of persons had been shot in their tracks, and thousands of others had mysteriously disappeared for saying a modicum of what she had said. Lenin, his face burning with anger, made answer to her. For the first time on record, he seems to have lost the cold self-command and faultless aplomb that are famous in him. For the first time also, he met attack upon his policies by descending to personal insult and worse. What should be her punishment at the hands of the dictatorship became now the question on all lips. If anyone else had said what she had said, the question would have been easily answered. But Marie Spiridonova, the most martyred saint of the revolution, the popular saint, the idol of the peasants, to whom it was said some of them actually prayed, that was a different matter. Marie Spiridonova, she could not be whisked away and disposed of in a cell or thrown into the Neva. For a few days, she was unmolested. Then she was quietly brought before some tribunal, no doubt convoked for the purpose, a judge to be insane and confined in an asylum. On February 1, 1919, she was reported still a prisoner in this place. And that was from Charles Edward Russell's Bolshevism in the United States. And ultimately, she was murdered by the NKVD, I believe.
Yeah, well, anybody that revered would be a threat to their authority.
So she wasn't for freedom. She was just for her own, how should I put it, her own brand of tyranny, wasn't she? Basically anarchism. And the anarchists are just dupes for the Jews.
Absolutely. They cause all the trouble and the Jew rises out of the ashes.
All right, the carrying of the resolution was received with cries of down with dictatorship, down with the commissars, to the courts with the Bolshevik hangmen and murderers. And these people don't realize, though, that a left socialist, left anarchist government will ultimately lead to all the problems that they're experiencing presently under the Bolshevik revolutionary government.
Absolutely.
That's the great tragedy of it. The government took steps to put down any further manifestations, and anyone found in possession of the resolution was at once arrested. Various promises were made, and money in the shape of the Kerensky notes was distributed by the Bolsheviks, but the workmen refused to be pacified and incited their comrades to strike. On 15 March, the Baltic, Skohorod, and Tromway works came out on strike. The situation was so serious that Lenin came from Moscow and attempted to pacify the workmen by speeches and promises of an extra bread ration. He also promised that passenger traffic between Petrograd and Moscow should be suspended for 4 weeks in order that the transport of supplies might be facilitated. Doesn't this happen in this country every time we're starting to get into an uproar? They send out stimulus checks in an attempt to appease us and placate us.
All the time. That's assuagement of the masses.
And they've been doing it for thousands of years, so why change their tactics halfway through the game?
Well, it's like the guy with the dog, you know? What was his name? Mendelssohn or whatever? Who, the guy that trained the dogs or the rats to act a particular
Pavlov.
Way? Pavlov, right. Pavlov's dogs. That's exactly what it's like. That they're conditioned. People are conditioned. They get all upset. Obama tells them, cut a $200 stimulus check for everybody, and everybody's happy.
But nobody realizes that they're not getting anything since the money can't come from nowhere, and we're all paying for it through inflation, taxation, and the fact that it's being added to our debt, and either they will pay it off, their children certainly will, and their grandchildren may even have to pay it off.
Oh, it goes back to that same lie. It all goes back to that same lie. People believe it every time.
You know, that something can come from nothing, and they don't realize that they may have a BMW now, but they're paying for it with the sweat from their grandchildren and children. Their grandchildren are doomed to be debt slaves.
There's no doubt.
You know, they should live it up right now so their grandchildren can ask why they're slaves in the land their forefathers built.
What sort of love is that? Yeah, you know, this Brokaw, whatever his name is, Tom Brokaw, wrote this book, The Greatest Generation. They were the greatest generation of idiots. I mean, they voted for Roosevelt 3-4 times. That they voted everything, every candidate that promised them something from nothing, they voted for.
And I'm sure if Roosevelt hadn't died, they'd have voted for him again.
And today they all buy into organizations like AARP that keep promising things for nothing, and they keep voting for it. And now they're replacing the underclasses with Mexicans. And the Mexicans in 20 years, when the Mexicans are the majority, they're not going to be wanting to support a bunch of old white retirees.
No,
so,
absolutely
so
not.
All
you know.
This whole white generation, this so-called greatest generation, has actually just sold out all of their own descendants.
For a comfortable life right here and now.
Right, exactly.
And, you know, Michael Moore made some remark that it'll be great when all these Mexicans come here because we'll have a socialized healthcare system, we'll have great social security. And I'm figuring, just like you said, 100 million Mexicans aren't going to pay diddly squat for a bunch of tired old white people living in retirement homes.
Hell no. And those Mexicans coming across the border, they see it as an invasion. They see it. They see themselves as conquerors. It's a reconquista.
That's why they behave like conquerors.
Absolutely.
I've said time and time again that we must look at non-white-on-white crime through the lens of a psychological campaign of terror. That's why when blacks move into an area or Mexicans move in, they engage in the most vicious, vile gang rapes, mutilations, drive-by shootings, stabbings. They behead people. They pour acid down people's throats. They do that to terrorize all the remaining residents into leaving, either just abandoning their homes outright, as is happening on the border of Arizona and Mexico, where many ranchers have just left their ranches and they've moved away because no one will buy it, or they sell it for a song to the first Negro or Mexican that offers them 5 cents on the dollar. But, I mean, obviously, if no one will buy your property because you live in an area that had 40 murders in the last week and 10 women were gang raped walking home from work, no one's going to buy your house. You're just going to have to leave or take the first offer you get. They're ethnically cleansing neighborhoods through sheer terror.
Well, you know, basically I see it as this greatest generation gave us the Eisenhower in the 50s and integration and the sexual revolution and the feminist revolution. And it's all the same generation of two of people that are responsible for all of this. And the Jews reward them now because they're patting good Goyim on the head. That's basically what's going on.
And they think they've done God's will and that they've been fair to the people of this country and that they've helped increase justice and fairness in the American way.
And most of those liberal whites have. They absolutely have. It's incredible. If you read this last paragraph, we're done with the main part of the Russia number one report.
All right. His proposals were refused, and the workmen demanded his resignation. Zinoviev and Lunasharsky, the only two commissars who dared to address the workmen, had no better success. Zinoviev was greeted with cries of "Down with that Jew!" and was compelled to escape. Lunasharsky found it impossible to obtain a hearing and eventually promised that the Bolsheviks would resign if the majority desired their resignation. I'm sure that never happened, of course, you know. Well, obviously it didn't happen, but I mean, did anybody actually follow through and demand it, or did they all turn up missing?
They probably all turned up missing.
The following couplet was placarded upon the walls of Petrograd: "Down with Lenin and horse flesh, give us the Tsar and pork."
Little too late for that, isn't it?
The genie can't be put back in the bottle.
Right. It's like somebody said a joke this afternoon about a picture of Bush saying, "Do you miss me yet?" Yeah, you know, it's like the same deal, you know. We traded one devil for a devil 10 times worse.
That's like Mao versus Stalin. Are you really any better with either one?
Right.
One will kill you fast, the other will kill you slow.
Right, evidently they had it in for the Tsar and went along with his demise, and they ended up in a worse hell.
And we've already shown that it was actually pretty decent under the Tsar.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. But people never, they always want something for nothing. They're always going to fall for the serpent's lie.
So the first guy that comes along and says, "Hey, you don't have enough, you can have so much more, just rise up and kill your leader, and we'll make sure you get everything you have coming to you." Well, in the end, they got everything they had coming to them.
Yes, they did.
A demand was made by the delegates of the Putilov Works that the resolution of 10th March should be published in the, quote, Northern Commune, but this was refused by the commissars of the interior. On 16th March, Torin incited Bolsheviks to kill the social revolutionaries
and Zinoviev brought into Petrograd a number of sailors and soldiers of the Red Army. The force was comprised of foreigners, mainly Letts and Germans, and I imagine that should read Jews from Germany. During the next 2 days, 300 arrests took place in the workshops, and suspected ringleaders and social revolutionaries were shot wholesale. Though order has been partially restored and many workmen have been driven to work by means of threats, they are still incensed against the Bolsheviks and demand the freedom of the press in order to voice their grievances. End report. And it seems just like what Bezmianov said, that these social revolutionaries, the liberals, the progressives, the intellectuals, they really get behind these communist movements at first, thinking that it'll be a great thing and all their goals will be implemented and all their ideas and everything, and that they will get to come to power with these communists. And then when the true communists come to power, all the liberals and the intellectuals, they're the first ones up against the wall.
Absolutely.
And that's what happened to Spirit de Novo. That's what happened to the left social revolutionaries. That's what happened to the anarchists. The anarchists were declared counter-revolutionary, and they were all killed.
Well, they destroyed,
or they were all...
they've destroyed themselves pursuing a lot in life that was not theirs to have, pursuing a lot in life, pursuing to improve their lives at the expense of others.
Hmm.
That's not very that's not very righteous, is it?
And the anarchists that weren't killed were simply exported to Western countries since they were no longer needed in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, exactly. And that started with the Frankfurt School.
You know, as Bezmianov said, once the communists come to power and they no longer have a crisis situation, they've normalized and stabilized everything from the revolution, they say no more revolutions, please. And it's you know, all revolutions are no longer welcome. They have no room for revolutionaries. Revolutionaries can go to another country.
And I think that next week, well, the week after next, when we do the appendix here, it's going to be pretty interesting.
Do you have any closing thoughts, sir?
No, I'm done. I'm done.
All right.
Well, let me say that there's one more quote that's interesting here from that I wanted to read, and it's actually from, if I could find it now, it's actually from Disraeli. The alliance between Jewish finance and revolutionary movements was no mystery to Disraeli. Lord Beaconsfield, for just after the European revolutionary upheaval of 1848, and this is the Disraeli who was the Prime Minister of Britain, right? He wrote, "The influence of the Jews may be traced back to the last outbreak of the destructive principle in Europe. An insurrection takes place against tradition and aristocracy, against religion and property. Destruction of the Semitic, well, that's an antinomer, principle, extirpation of the Jewish religion, whether in the Mosaic or the Christian form, the natural equality of man and the abrogation of property are proclaimed by the secret societies who form provisional governments, and men of the Jewish race are found at the head of every one of them." Well, he calls them the people of God, right? Well, that's the people of Satan cooperate with atheists. The most skillful accumulators of property ally themselves with communists. The peculiar and chosen race touch the hand of all the scum and low castes of Europe. And all this because they wish to destroy that ungrateful Christendom which owes to them even its name and whose tyranny they can no longer endure. So you know, he tells the truth about the Jews. He doesn't tell the truth about their history because he doesn't know it. But he surely tells the truth about their nature and that the fact that they are behind all of these secret societies that destroy our governments. And that was written in The Life of Lord George Bentinck, page 497, 1852.
All right. So our next show will be not next week, but the Sunday after.
Yes.
All right. Well, I look forward to the program then.
2 weeks.
Thank you. Yahweh bless.
God bless.